Chapter 16. For once there was no crowd waiting to greet Elaine Doy as the presidential limousine pulled up smoothly. The bodyguards riding with her still went through the disembarkation procedure, scanning the area, running identity requests on the few people who were standing outside the gateway control center. It was a nondescript building made from a high-density metal stone amalgamation with slim recessed vertical windows, the kind of office block that would be rented by a small company going nowhere. In this case, it was, very literally, in the shade of the Hanco Wormhole Generator Building, whose composite panel sides rose up behind the gateway control like a vertical mountain. Presidential security gave the okay, and the limousine's thick, armored doors unlocked. The pressure seal that protected her from chemical and biological attack disengaged, and the force field switched off. "I see Nigel hasn't bothered to come and welcome me," the president complained. How the Unisphere shows would love that slight. He'd sent some station management types to wait on the steps for her instead. "Remember the Michelangelo feed is live?" Patricia warned as the door irised apart. As she stepped out of the limousine, Doy's smile had the appropriate gravitas for the occasion. She thanked the two CST managers for sparing the time to greet her at what must be a frantically busy time for them on this historic day. Nodded courteously at the reporter from the Michelangelo show standing to one side, and let herself be ushered inside. The control center itself had undergone a hurried modification over the last few days, with over a dozen new consoles crammed into the narrow aisles between the existing two rows. Whereas before, under normal operating conditions, there would be no more than three or four people in the center at any one time, each position now had a technician sitting at it, while more specialists and engineers stood behind them monitoring the new procedures. In addition, the back wall was lined with dignitaries, including Michelangelo himself, who'd arm-twisted an invitation out of CST. With only half an hour to go before the wormhole was switched to its new advanced temporal flow mode, the atmosphere was strained and excited. None of the technical staff were bothering to use the communications links. They shouted questions and comments around the center at high volume. "It's worse than a Senate debate," Doy said from the corner of her mouth as they entered the control center. Patricia's neutral expression never flickered. Nigel Sheldon came over to greet her, apologetic that he hadn't been at the front entrance earlier. "Things are getting a little tense around here," he explained. "They even asked my advice on exotic matters, Stress. I was quite flattered." "I'm sure you gave them every help," Doy said tightly. She was very aware of the Michelangelo reporter standing a few paces away, capturing everything for the Unisphere audience. In her virtual vision grid, the total access number was creeping up to the kind of level that the last Prime invasion had generated. "We all contribute what we can," Nigel said in a very condescending tone. Raphael Columbia came over to welcome Doy. "Admiral," she said in relief. At least he would be more formal. The occasion deserved it, she felt. "How is the Navy coping with the remaining Prime ships?" she said, as if the Prime Armadas were some minor problem left over, a few spaceships already on the run from superior Commonwealth forces.
"Secure in this system, Madam President," Raphael said. "We now have 8 frigates assigned to elimination duty. Over half of the Prime ships have been successfully eliminated. The rest are in flight. Protecting Wessex with its wormhole generators is imperative. We will guarantee it at all costs."
"I'm sure you will, Admiral."
Which didn't quite equate the briefing he'd given her 10 hours ago. The Prime ships in many of the second 47 systems were trying to congregate into swarms, merging their defense capabilities while they attempted to find a suitable asteroid or moon to claim as a new home. But in 7 systems, the gathering swarms were heading into the Commonwealth worlds. The Navy had diverted frigates to try to deflect the inward migration, but the numbers were against them. Those 7 planets were going to have a tough time of it during the next week while the evacuation progressed.
"We're almost ready," Nigel said.
He and Doy walked down to the front of the control center while the noise died down. The 5 big holographic portals on the wall were projecting data schematics for the wormhole. The central one switched to a picture of Hanco's premier speaker, Hasimir Aurum.
"Mr. Sheldon, Madame President," he said.
Doyle was very aware of the hostile undercurrent in his voice, and hoped no one else would pick up on it. The last talk she'd had with him, 5 hours ago, had been short and antagonistic. Starting with his dismay that Hanko was going to be the first to begin evacuating into the future, or, as he put it, the experiment to test if the whole lunatic time-travel idea worked. Right up to the fact that Nigel wasn't kidding about not letting anyone opt out of the operation. Aurum had wanted to be allowed back into the Commonwealth so he could monitor the preparations being made for his people on their new planet. "Hello, Hasimir," Doy said. "We're about to open the wormhole for you. Everyone here is ready. We're leaving with great sadness, but also a sense of hope and pride. Hanko's society will flourish again. I have no doubt of that. I look forward to visiting and experiencing your triumph in the flesh."
"Asimir," Nigel said, "the wormhole is ready. We've got a direct lock on the gateway at Anagaska. It's opening now."
"Anagaska it is then," Asimir Aurum said. "Make sure we've got some decent weather when we arrive."
"Consider it done," Nigel said.
Anagaska was a Phase 3 world, 8 light-years from Balkash, which CST had already advanced to pre-development state. Its position close to the Lost 23 was another source of Hasimir's anger, but as Nigel had told him and all the other Second 47 planetary leaders, the Wessex-based wormholes couldn't reach the other side of the Commonwealth. Doy watched the image pull back from Hasimir. The Premier Speaker had been standing beside a dark green 6-seat Audi Tyrol that was parked directly in front of the Hanko Gateway. The train tracks had been ripped up and replaced by a vast apron of enzyme-bonded concrete that had been poured without any finesse over the ground all the way back to the main highway leading to the planetary station. It was starting to look like that wasn't going to be nearly enough. The silence in the control center was broken with a buzz of incredulity as the Hanko station yard expanded across the portal. It was covered with vehicles of every description, from open trikes to 20-wheeled trucks. The police had done their best to line them up in columns, but the patrol cars had soon become surrounded and blocked by the sheer volume of the evacuation vehicles. Their strobes were all that gave away their position, points of bright light flashing amid the vast multicolored carpets that covered the entire station. At some point, perspective failed, and the vehicles looked like blocks in a city grid, a city that had a vast black river winding through the center. That was the people who didn't have a car or truck or bike, who'd arrived at the planetary station on one of the thousands of trains collecting them from across the planet. Local news media had estimated that there were already over 7 million people on foot waiting to walk through the gateway. A frosty mauve light shone out of the opened gateway. For once, not the light of a distant sun, but radiated by the exotic matter itself. Normally, the wormhole's internal length was so close to zero, it was for all intents and purposes immeasurable. This one was a glowing tunnel that extended a good way to infinity and was still lengthening. Air roared into it as the pressure curtain was shut down. Cheers and applause began in the control center, building in volume. Doy joined in, clapping warmly, smiling congratulations at Nigel. Hasimir Aurum drove himself and his family into the wormhole. There had also been a lot of debate about whether he should be first or last. Hasimir had wanted to be last. "It is the decent thing," he claimed. "I won't have anyone's respect if I slink away first and leave everybody else to wait for the atmosphere to collapse and the prime ships to start their bombardment." Nigel had overruled that. "Hanko is going to be the first planet to leave for the future, for better or worse. People are going to be frightened of what's ahead. You need to lead by example, to show them there is nothing to fear. You must take that first step yourself." A seething Hasimir agreed to go first, leaving the Deputy Premier Speaker to bring up the rear. Doy watched for several minutes as the traffic began to flow into the wormhole. Those on foot rushed forward, shepherded between two lines of police. She saw two or three fall. Didn't see anyone stop and help them. With a quick glance to make sure the Michelangelo reporter wasn't focusing on her, she asked Nigel, "What happens if the generator fails?"
"They die," he said. "Simple as that. But don't worry. Our generators are designed for long-term continuous usage, and we can sustain the wormhole with a different generator whenever the primary needs maintenance and refurbishment. It can be done. I would not have suggested this if there was too great a risk. She didn't think she'd ever seen him so intent and sincere. It bestowed a curious feeling of confidence. How are the other generator modifications progressing? We should be able to start the evacuations on Vyborg, Omoloi, and Illichio within a few hours. The rest will be completed within 3 days. How long individual worlds take to shove their populations through is up to their governments. Some are coping better than others.
And our other problem?
We'll discuss that in a secure facility.
Yes, of course.
She looked over at Michelangelo, who cocked an eyebrow expectantly.
I'd better go and do my PR.
Michelangelo's welcoming smile was broad and horribly earnest. Doi got a sinking feeling as she approached the media giant. There was just so much war-related news she couldn't even keep up with that, let alone ordinary current events. Patricia had given her a reasonable briefing on the trip to Wessex, and the presidential office had a full rebuttal service online ready for her, although any pause to consult would be jumped on by a true pro like Michelangelo. "Madam President," he said formally, bowing slightly.
"Michelangelo, pleased to see you.
We're running ground reviews for another minute, then we'll switch straight to interview."
"Fine."
Doi positioned the rebuttal team icon to the middle of her virtual vision and pulled the show feed from her grid. Hanko-based reporters were moving through the awesome crowd outside the gateway, snatching comments at random. Mostly they were good-natured. Everyone was pulling together. A man who was giving an elderly neighbor a lift with his family. Bus company employees who'd volunteered to drive the buses loaded with patients from the hospitals. Young kids who'd grabbed pets. People helping out other people. The refugees were a community pulling together in the worst crisis they'd ever known. They gave the ruined sky above the force field resentful looks, but spoke about the trip through the wormhole with cautious optimism. Some snide remarks about Hasimir saving his ass first, which made Doi tighten her lips in disapproval. There was anger that nothing more had been done to save their world, and a lot of heartache about everything they were being forced to leave behind. The feed switched to Michelangelo.
"So, Madam President, now we've seen the temporal displacement start. Do you think anything more could have been done to save Hanko and the remaining second 47 planets?"
"Not a thing," Doi said.
"The Navy did a magnificent job." "Sorry to interrupt, but you've just fired Admiral Keim. That doesn't sound to me that you were satisfied with the Navy's performance."
"The ships and their crews performed superbly.
It was the way they were prioritized that gave the War Cabinet grave concern. Consequently, we had no alternative but to accept Admiral Keim's resignation. I cannot hide from the fact that we didn't have enough starships, and that is a major funding issue which Senator Goldreich is examining. But the sheer scale of the alien invasion is still something we are all coming to terms with."
"Are you worried that more attacks will be forthcoming?"
"No. We have taken steps to ensure this atrocity will not be repeated."
"I understand you can't give any details, but how confident can you be of that?"
"Completely.
We have all seen how powerful our weapons have become. I accept responsibility for the ultimate outcome from the deployment of such power against living creatures, but I will not hold back from defending the Commonwealth. I believe in us. I believe we have a right to exist. Something I'm sure my rival, or I should say, ex-rival, Alessandra Baron, believed in too. Can you tell us why Senate security forces thought it necessary to kill her during an attempt at arrest? Did she ask one awkward question too many in the Senate dining hall?"
A century of politics in the front line enabled the president to keep her expression calm, but it was a close thing.
"I'm sorry, Michelangelo, but as you well know, I can't comment on an active classified case."
"So you do know what Alessandra's alleged crime was?"
"I can't comment."
"Very well. Can you tell us why Boongate has dropped out of the Unisphere? Have the prime ships successfully invaded?"
"Certainly not. The Navy is keeping them off every second 47 world."
"Then why is there no Unisphere link?"
I believe the physical connection has failed. It's unusual and unfortunate at this time, but there's nothing mysterious about it. I assure you we are in contact with Boongate through secure government links. They're just not wide enough to provide a full Unisphere connection. Did the linkage failure have anything to do with the wormhole being reopened? I am not aware of the wormhole to Boongate being reopened. It was for a very short time. According to some of the refugees who took advantage of the opening to come here to Wessex, and we've interviewed four so far, 3 trains went through from here. What was on those trains, Madam President? What was so important that they were using lethal force to protect? They were shooting at each other, weren't they? You're asking me questions about a local incident which I've never heard of. The Office of President doesn't exist as a research facility for news shows. I can only suggest you direct your queries about gunfire to the local police.
Fair enough, Madam President. Finally, can you tell us if it's true your Chief of Staff, Patricia Cantill, was called in for questioning by Senate Security?
I can tell you that Patricia Cantill has my complete confidence. Thank you.
Elaine Doy turned on a heel and marched away.
Thank you, Madam President, Michelangelo called after her. There was a great deal of mockery in his voice.
The presidential bodyguard fell in around Elaine as she left the control center, her face a perfect image of contentment. Patricia walked beside her, saying nothing, equally happy-looking. Once they were back in the presidential limousine, Elaine checked the screening was on, then kicked the door.
Where the fuck does that dickhead get off asking me those questions? She yelled. Egotistical shit! I'll fucking have him shot if he pulls a stunt like that again.
Don't say that, even in private, Patricia said. One day you'll slip and say it in public.
Right.
Doy kicked the door again, with feeling.
Bastard! Who gave him all that information, for Christ's sake?
And was it true about the Boongate wormhole?
Someone's leaking badly.
I suspect it's being done to soften the shock impact when the public finally gets to hear the Star Flyer is real. That would indicate the Navy was behind Michelangelo's illicit briefing. Specifically Columbia, the bastard. He's building a perception in the public mind that they're on the ball.
Doy gave Patricia what amounted to a guilty look. How much damage can the Star Flyer do us?
It's been manipulating Commonwealth politics for decades.
70 planets have been destroyed and millions of people killed.
We almost lost the war because of cost considerations.
Voter mistrust of politicians has never been stronger.
Frankly, there'll be a bloodbath at the next elections. Our assessment team estimates around 70% of the current senators will lose their seats.
And my re-election chances?
Patricia drew a breath.
I'll resign as your Chief of Staff as soon as Sheldon wipes out Dyson Alpha.
That should give you some distance from the Starflyer.
Only in a fair and just universe.
Nobody's going to forget the shotgun about me being one of its agents. Not now.
It was black propaganda.
The Starflyer sent it.
Isabella.
Her mouth flattened in anger. Elaine put a sympathetic hand on the other woman's shoulder.
I'm sorry. They said it corrupted her mind when she was a child.
Jesus.
Can you imagine that? A little girl having her brain invaded by that monster. What she must have gone through. The suffering.
Tears began to well up as she bent over, her head falling into her hands.
It's over now,
Elaine said, rubbing Patricia's spine as the uncontrollable sobbing began.
What I saw of her. There were glimpses of what she could have been like. How beautiful her life could have been. I should have known, should have realized something was wrong. A teenager giving me advice on political strategy. Me, of all people. But I loved her, so I never questioned.
She can still be that person you thought you saw. They can root the Star Flyer out of her memories, turn her back to a full human being.
Patricia sat back up, dabbing at the moisture on her face. I'm sorry. This is stupid of me.
I understand. And I don't want your resignation.
We'll face this together.
Elaine sighed.
If there's going to be a future we can face it in. God alone knows what is really going on.
Sheldon's got himself a little bunch of cohorts who are calling all the shots.
I mean, we didn't even know about the Boongate wormhole. What the hell did happen there? None of my sources knew about it.
Damn it, I'm the president!
That doesn't mean a lot to Sheldon or the other dynasties. He is going to wipe out Dyson Alpha, isn't he? For all he's a ruthless bastard, he does have a sense of honor. If he said he'll do it, he will. Hell, I hope you're right.
Ilanum wasn't like a normal town. It was founded to act as a supply depot for all the estates that the Sheldon dynasty scattered over the planet, coupled with a small airport for the hypersonics that flew the ultra-wealthy to their extremely private homes. There was also housing and a few select malls for the thousands of technicians and specialist construction workers and household staff who helped maintain the estates. Urban expansion also extended to schools for the children of senior dynasty members, stores promoting the most expensive designer items to be found in the Commonwealth, and a few high-class, low-morals leisure clubs whose existence was a constant source of semi-envious rumor on the tackier Unisphere gossip shows. Not all the dynasty members invited by Nigel to build a residence on Crescent favored the splendid isolation route. They preferred a tighter community that had some interaction and built themselves townhouses instead. The district Ozzy drove through didn't exactly suffer from population pressure or a shortage of space. Houses were vast, set inside huge open grounds. His Mercedes cab was the only vehicle on the road that seemed curiously narrow amid such ostentation.
"Who are we visiting?"
Melanie asked. "Old friend," Ozzy said reluctantly. He thought he recognized some of the ridiculous buildings they were driving past, like the Crimson Pyramid and the Scottish baronial castle inside its own moat, but it had been a long time, and he didn't want to check the location with the local net. Nigel and Nelson might well have discovered his backdoor authorization codes by now. He also knew his disappearance would be noticed at some point, sooner rather than later. When that happened, all hell would break loose. Dynasty security would run a forensic audit through the mansion's network and discover traces of the SI subroutine. Nigel would go apeshit about that. He'd never really trusted the SI. Infiltrating a copy into his dynasty's secure world was essentially a declaration of war. A ghostly white building that was all vertical curves and long balconies slid into view on the top of a small rise, where it commanded a view right across the surrounding district.
"Ah, here we go,"
he said, and turned off up the drive. Ozzy knew the house array's sensors had seen him. He just hoped he was still cleared for authorized entry. In fact, he hoped it was still her house. Reasonable enough assumption. People here didn't sell up and move like they did on ordinary worlds. With his aversion to establishing a link to any part of Crescent's net still riding high, Ozzy didn't try to call ahead to see if anyone was inside. Instead, he rapped on the tall metal door. When Melanie put her hands on her hips and gave him a maddened stare, he just shrugged lamely. There was a sound of bare feet walking on a wooden floor. The door swung open, revealing a pink and orange hallway. A woman was standing there, dressed in a black robe, her hair in disarray. Ozzy squinted.
"Giselle? What the fuck do you think you're doing?"
"Hi, babe."
Ozzy smiled brightly.
"Surprise! Dickhead, why are you here?
I missed you.
Can we talk inside?" Giselle Swinsel glowered at Melanie.
"Who's this? You look familiar."
"Melanie. The media, bitch. Try recording me and I will personally rip your throat out, reach down the hole and pull your dying heart out so you can watch it stop beating.
I don't record ugly, boring people."
"Ladies."
Ozzy held his hands out to both of them.
"Please, come on. A little civility here.
Giselle, Melanie is a good friend.
She's not working on a story, are you?"
"Probably not," Melanie said querulously. "There, see? Everything is cool."
Giselle glared at him again.
"Cool? You think this is cool?"
Her arm came up fast, and she landed a perfectly aimed slap on Ozzy's cheek. She stomped off back into the house, leaving the door open.
Ozzy tried to wriggle his jaw back into place. It hurt. There were red blotches interfering with his vision. Melanie's smile had returned. Old girlfriend. Wife, Ozzy explained wearily. He ventured inside. Crockery was being slammed around in the kitchen.
Did we interrupt dinner?
Ozzy asked. The decor had been changed some time over the last century, he noticed. The kitchen fittings were now all jet black with glass doors. Scarlet worktops glowed faintly, casting a hazy hue on the ceiling. Chic, antique Miami bar stools surrounded the long breakfast bar.
Breakfast!
Giselle snapped. She tugged a coffee mug from a maidbot's tentacles and shoved it into the dishwasher cabinet. I've been working 26/7, and I'm tired, and I've got to get back in another hour.
Doing what?
I'm not telling you that. I knew Nigel would give you a senior post in the Dynasty Starship Project. After all, it's practically your planet. You were the best choice to head the research team into the planters. How is all the Giga life, by the way?
Like me, it survives perfectly well without you.
I need a favor.
Then you should ask someone who cares about you.
There must be one person in the Commonwealth, surely.
Okay, bad approach. I'm sorry. I'm here because I need to get up to the starships.
Ozzy! She grabbed a side plate. He didn't think she'd throw it.
I see you kept the memories of us, then.
Giselle tipped her head to one side as her expression turned menacingly calm.
Oh, yes. Won't get fooled again. Thank you.
I need help, man. Please, Giselle.
He was surprised at how shaky his voice had become. This really was the final throw of the dice. If Giselle didn't come through, it was truly all over. He wasn't sure he could live in a universe in which such a crime had been committed.
I know what I did before. I kept the memories of us, too. But please, please trust me this one last time. I have to get to the starships. You know what Nigel is going to do, don't you?
What has to be done?
It doesn't.
Ozzy thought he caught a tiny flicker of doubt.
There's a chance, he persisted.
A small, pitiful, weak chance that I might be right and genocide can be averted. Let me take that chance. It's only me that will be at risk. I'm not going to drag anyone else down with me. Just let me do what I have to do. That's all I ask. Please.
God damn you!
Giselle's free hand thumped the scarlet worktop.
God damn you, Oswald Isaac.
Melanie's smile had been in place the whole drive from Giselle's house to the gateway. She kept seeing Orion's face. His astonishment, delight, laughing, awestruck. She looked up curiously as soon as they emerged from the other side of the gateway. The sun on this world hadn't quite risen yet. A thick gentian light was only just sliding up out of the eastern horizon to diminish the stars. Something moved quickly. High overhead. Something huge.
Oh, wow!
Melanie exclaimed, pressing herself to the car's passenger window. The space flower traversed the sky, almost invisible, it was so dark.
It was so big.
From the driver's seat, Giselle made a dismissive sound. More secrets locked away in a single molecule here than Newton and Baker ever figured between them, Ozzy said.
Really?
Melanie said, all mock attention.
Oswald,
she sniggered. Giselle chuckled disrespectfully. Ozzy folded his arms across his chest and glowered out at the sterile landscape. Melanie grinned again. They were following an Abel's 40-wheel transporter carrying a big sphere swathed in polythene and orange wrap straps. The truck behind them was laden with standard cargo pods, gray-white cylinders with environmental hoses plugged into the end. Melanie had been surprised by how many vehicles were on the road and the size of their loads. The Sheldon Dynasty's lifeboat project was clearly pitched an order of magnitude above all the others. Giselle drove them along the unnamed town's ring road until they approached what appeared to be a medium-sized industrial park. Pylons rose above the highest roofs, floodlighting the whole area. Under the intense blue-tinged light, Melanie could see that most of the warehouses were joined together in a fishbone pattern. She recognized the wormhole generator building at one end, larger than all the others, its dark paneling more substantial. Behind it were four big fusion generators. A circle of concrete conical towers stood guard around the whole area. The road took them in toward the complex, passing through a broad arch that seemed to be made from silvery scales. "Here we go," Giselle said in a nervous whisper. "If the RI hasn't accepted my personal updates, you can kiss your ass goodbye, Oswald. The smallest perimeter weapons here are atom lasers." They drove under the arch. Melanie's inserts reported a scan that was almost sophisticated enough to detect them. Giselle held her breath. She was hunched up over the steering wheel, expecting the worst. "I never could figure out that insecurity of yours," Ozzy said. "Nobody ever questions the boss." "The corporate management expert speaks," Giselle sneered. "Do you have any idea how..." "Oh, forget it." She relaxed her hold on the steering wheel. Giselle parked in her reserved slot outside the administration block and led them directly to the locker room on the ground floor. Melanie pulled on a shapeless green jumpsuit of semi-organic fabric, which then contracted around her. Its knees and elbows puffed out, providing her with protection against knocks in freefall. Giselle handed her a white helmet. Ozzy was already trying to stuff his hair into one. Eventually, he gave up and left the straps dangling down. The wormhole leading to the orbiting assembly platform cluster was a standard commercial model, the type CST used for its train network, with a circular gateway 30 meters wide. Even that was only just large enough to swallow the spherical compartments that rode into it on a broad malmetal conveyor system. Melanie stood on the walkway at the side of the transfer hall that led to the gateway and watched two of the spheres slide past. All their polythene and protective webbing had been removed, leaving the silver-white surface exposed. Given that the exterior was designed to withstand the rigors of deep space exposure, it seemed relatively delicate. She wondered what Paul would give to see this. It was strange, thinking these modules were designed to fly halfway across the galaxy, never to return, that the starships which they would form could actually seed a whole new civilization. She'd looked at paintings in the Great Moments history book that showed the colony boats arriving in Australia. This must be the modern equivalent. The spheres gave way to a whole series of much smaller cargo pods. "All right," Giselle said. "We're on." The three of them moved along the walkway to the gateway. On the other side, Melanie could see the assembly platform's reception module. First impression was the inside of a globe that had been covered with the raw architecture of factories. It was an intricate orb of girders that seemed to be rippling constantly. She realized that the grid was host to hundreds of bots scurrying about, while on the underside, manipulator arms were in permanent motion. Bright scarlet holograms flashed over half of the girders, warning people off the mechanical systems. The spheres and cargo pods passed sedately along branches of the conveyor to disappear down metallic tunnels leading out to various starship bays. Ahead of her, where the walkway ended at the gateway, people were grabbing onto hand hoops that skimmed along an electromuscle rail which took them inside the reception module. "I've programmed the system to take us to the frigate dock," Giselle said. "Just hang on." When she reached the end of the walkway, Melanie imitated what she'd seen Giselle do and simply grabbed one of the hoops. Its plastic handle responded by flowing securely around her hand, and it moved forward along the electromuscle band, hauling her along. Gravity vanished abruptly, and Melanie clamped her mouth down hard as every instinct told her she was falling. After a minute, she got her breathing back under control and tentatively began to enjoy the ride. The only thing preventing her from the full novelty was her stomach, which seemed uncomfortably queasy. Orion had told her about that sensation when the Pathfinder fell over the water worldlet. She smiled fondly. "Crazy boy." Melanie was carried around a quarter of the reception module, where the mechanical sounds of the bots and manipulator arms reached stadium crowd volume. Then they curved around to travel along one of the big tunnels. It branched, then split into five. The handle carried her down the smallest passage at the junction, only 4 meters wide. There was a malmetal airlock door at the end. An orange hologram illuminated the air in front of it, reading, "Authorized personnel only." Giselle anchored herself on a fuse tube patch and put her hand on the eyespot control. The airlock door peeled back in 5 segments. They moved forward and the segments closed behind them. Melanie suddenly felt claustrophobic in the chamber. It took a lot of willpower not to snap out, "Hurry up!" A few seconds later, the outer door peeled open. The frigate dock was a metal cylinder 300 meters long and 70 wide, with an open end sealed off by a pressure curtain that glowed electric purple. Unlike the assembly bays, the interior was almost devoid of manipulator arms. 3 weapons-loading cradles were resting on the solid end, their telescoping lift limbs fully retracted. 2 ellipsoid frigates were docked opposite each other halfway along the cylinder, the Charybdis and the Scylla. Scylla was enclosed by curving mesh platforms that gave bots and technicians access to every square inch of the infinite black hull. Several people were working on her. The Charybdis was almost clear except for 3 umbilical arms and a plyplastic access cage over its open airlock. Ozzy stared at the frigate with a greedy smile.
"Man, oh man, is it armed?"
"I don't know," Giselle said in a subdued tone. Now they were in the docking bay, she seemed almost puzzled that they'd made it this far. "They're scheduled to leave in another 5 hours, so it should be."
"Let's go find out."
Ozzy kicked off hard, soaring across the docking bay. After a moment, Giselle followed him. It was no longer freefall that was making Melanie feel sick. She was genuinely scared now. The frigates looked chillingly powerful. That they were built for aggression could never be in doubt. And the fact that one or probably both were carrying a Nova bomb didn't help her nerves. She started to activate her inserts, configuring them to scan for any activity.
"It can't be this easy," she muttered.
Her doubts were beginning to be overtaken by a growing excitement.
"Dear heavens, I'm going to hijack a Dynasty frigate. I'm going to fly to Dyson Alpha to end the war."
"Me?" She jumped across the wide open space. Ozzy had landed on the wall not far from the Charybdis. He used the fuse tube patches on his cuffs and soles to scuttle along like a crab until he reached a thick pillar supporting one of the umbilical arms. A man in a green jumpsuit and white helmet emerged from the frigate and started shouting. Ozzy waved back cheerfully. Giselle landed beside him and started to calm the man.
"You must recognize Ozzy," Melanie heard her say as soon as she was in range.
"Well, yes," he replied. "Hi there, dude."
"Yes, hello. But nobody put this on the schedule."
"Mark, come on," Giselle said. "You know the schedule changes faster than anyone can keep up."
Melanie landed on the side of the dock and struggled not to fly off again. Fuse tube patches were damn difficult to work. She studied her feet for a moment to make sure they were secure, then looked up. Her face split into a wide smile.
"Hello, Mark."
"Huh?"
Mark gulped in disbelief.
"Melanie?"
Giselle gave her an alarmed look.
"You two know each other?"
"We're old best friends," Melanie drawled in her huskiest voice.
Sure enough, Mark's face turned red.
"She's a reporter," Mark protested, "and she works for the SI. I thought the Dynasty didn't want it on this planet."
"And she saved your ass," Melanie said. "How are Barry and Sandy?"
Mark made an embarrassed grumbling sound in his throat.
"Mark, I'm engaged to Nigel now," Melanie said. "I'm going to be one of his harem.
So you'd be nice to the boss's wife."
Ozzy's face screwed up into surprise.
"You're engaged to Nige?"
"He proposed the other night."
"You never said."
He shook his head.
"Okay, not relevant. Mark, I'm just up here to do my inspection tour, okay? Plus, I'm really dying to see the frigate. It'd bust my rep if anyone found out what a serious tech head I am. But I gotta say, this is one smooth piece of engineering.
Giselle told me all about the searcher flight and what you did."
"Well, you know," Mark said.
It was a tone that hinted at a lot of secret pride.
I guess we all owe you, huh?
Ozzy had reached Mark's side and patted him man to man on the shoulder.
The pilots are the important guys, Mark said.
Come on. Remember, I built the very first wormhole generator with my own hand. I know how much skill it takes to integrate machinery. Thought we'd never get that mother finished. And this.
He ran his hand over the hull. This has to be orders of magnitude above and beyond that antique.
Respect to you, assembly dudes. I mean that.
Thanks.
Let's go check out the cabin, huh? Mark gave Giselle one last questioning look. She nodded her approval.
Sure thing, Mark said.
He started to worm his way back down into the frigate's airlock.
Careful here. There's not a lot of room.
Ozzy flashed a triumphant grin at Melanie and Giselle and followed Mark on board.
Did you make that up?
Giselle asked.
What?
Melanie was close enough to the frigate to reach out and touch it. She held back, still awed by its raw power. The hull was so black it looked like a bubble of interstellar space. She half expected to see galaxies floating inside.
About Nigel? Are you engaged?
Oh, that. She finally pressed her hand against the frigate. It was a historic moment, after all. The surface was completely frictionless and thermal neutral. Tactile nerves told her she was touching something, but that was all the impression she got. Her eyes couldn't actually focus on it.
He did propose.
I haven't said yes yet. Giselle gave the frigate's open airlock a twitchy look.
Take my advice and say yes.
That way he might not fling you into suspension for more than 1,000 years.
Come on. Ozzy has to do this.
How do you think he's going to get rid of Mark?
Has he...
She trailed off fast. Her inserts were telling her the docking bay airlock was opening. Dense and very powerful energy sources were emerging.
Oh, crap.
What? Somebody's here. Not good. Warn Ozzy. She pushed off lightly, gliding around the frigate's curving hull. The entire communication spectrum was suddenly filled by a single signal.
You, by the Charybdis, do not move. Deactivate any weapons you are carrying.
Melanie slid around the ultra-black hull to find herself looking directly at a squad of armored suits flying out of the airlock like angry wasps. Active sensors locked onto her. She instinctively tried to deflect them. Her hands and cheeks began to ripple with silver lines.
No!
Giselle shrieked. An instant of disconnection. And Melanie found herself spinning violently. She didn't know why. Her body had gone numb, apart from the single sensation of cold sweat prickling her forehead. She thought it was the prequel to vomiting, but she couldn't even feel her stomach. Then she smacked into the docking bay wall and rebounded. Her limbs didn't seem to be working either. It was strange. She didn't feel any pain. That had been a nasty impact. Red dots drifted across her vision, which appeared to be dimming. Sensation came rushing back in on her consciousness in a terrifying wave of pain. She tried to wail, but liquid was blocking her throat. She couldn't breathe. Her body was alive with agony, at its worst, down her left side. She coughed, trying to clear her lungs. Streamers of blood poured out of her mouth, then wobbled crazily in front of her. Her hand scrabbled at the main source of the pain, finding only warm, wet jelly. Thick webs of oscillating blood were spinning around her. On the other side of them, a giant black shape slid past. Turbulence from its wake swatted the blood, splatting it against her. Her need to breathe was excruciating. She coughed again and more blood bubbled out of her throat, forming sticky ribbons in front of her. Her whole body juddered. The pain was now submerging itself below an intense cold. A face appeared above her.
Nigel.
Melanie tried to smile. He looked very angry.
Get a fucking medical kit here. Now.
She tried to tell him it'd be fine. She was okay, really. That just allowed more blood to escape. It was very red. Her vision was closing in.
Melanie.
Nigel's voice, a long way off. There was so much she wanted to say. She wondered if Orion had woken up yet.
but now the blackness conquered everything. Ozzy had been inside an Apollo command module once. The Smithsonian staff had removed the Perspex cover from the hatchway and stood by with nervous smiles as he squirmed around the historic antique interior. He couldn't remember how long ago that was now, at least 2 centuries, but he did recall marveling at how 3 people had survived in such a small space for the 10 days it took to travel to the moon and back. As he followed Mark through the Charybdis airlock and into the cabin, he began to feel a twinge of envy for those old astronauts and the abundant room they had back then. The frigate's cabin was small. 3 couches fixed to the rear bulkhead, the reason he suddenly remembered the Apollo, with a 1.5-meter gap between them and the forward bulkhead that was a solid wall of arrays and portals. "Is this it?" he asked in amazement. "Sure is." Mark had levered himself into the left-hand couch and smiled knowingly at him. "You claustrophobic?" "We're about to find out." Ozzy slid into the central couch. The arrays in front of his nose were covered in symbols he didn't recognize, but they were powered up. He found an eye spot and pressed his hand against it. "Can you interface?" he asked the SI subroutine.
"Yes."
"Do it fast."
"Working."
"Hey," he asked Mark, "is the Nova Bomb on board?" Mark seemed a little easier that Ozzy knew about such things.
"Yeah.
We're still waiting for the Scylla's bomb to be delivered. They promised it in another 3 hours. Not sure we'll have the system's integration sorted by then, but we should be able to launch tomorrow. So how many quantum busters have we got?" Ozzy made it sound like a school kid asking questions. "Next, it'd be how fast does it go, mister?"
"All 10 loaded," Mark said.
"Man, that is a shitload of firepower." Ozzy felt indecently happy. The great frigate heist was online and powering up smoothly. He could probably let rumors about this one slip out into the Unisphere.
"You're telling me?"
Mark peered at one of the portal displays. He glanced over at Ozzy's hand on the eye spot.
"I have command of all primary functions," the SI subroutine said.
A plethora of frigate command icons rose up into Ozzy's virtual vision. Compressed instruction text orbited each one like a gas giant ring. Just reading all the introductions would have taken a couple of hours. He assumed he'd be able to do most of the piloting himself. After all, how difficult could it be? It looked like he was going to be more dependent on the SI subroutine than he liked. Despite everything that had happened, he still wasn't sure he trusted it.
"Hey, what are you loading in?"
Mark asked in growing alarm.
"Ozzy," Giselle called. "We've got..." "Oh, shit."
Ozzy's inserts picked up the warning from the security team. "Close the airlock and get us out of here," he told the SI subroutine. His virtual hand took a broad swipe at all the command icons, sweeping them away like clutter off a desk. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Mark putting his hand out toward an eye spot. "Stop it!" he barked. "I've got the kind of weapons wet wiring that can slaughter a small army. Killing you from this range is easier than breathing. Sit back and do nothing and I'll let you live."
"Don't kill me,"
Mark wailed. His hand drew back as if the eye spot was wired up to 1,000 volts.
"Christ, man, I've got a family. Kids."
"Shut up." The airlock hatch contracted. Ozzy just heard a loud, unpleasant snap from outside before it shut completely. He searched around for a button on his couch that would activate the restraint webbing. That was far too simple for this ship. He gave up. "Strap me in," he told the SI subroutine.
"Confirmed.
And give me some visuals from outside. I want to see what's going down." The couch's ply plastic cushioning flowed over his shoulders and hips, securing him tight. 5 grids in his virtual vision display came on, and he pulled the pictures out. A whole squad of armored figures was zipping out into the docking bay. Then Melanie drifted in front of a camera. Half of her left side had been torn away. Long tatters of gore hung from exposed, shattered ribs. Her face swung into view, staring directly into the lens. For some reason, she possessed a zen-like serenity. Then her lips twitched, and arterial blood foamed out of her mouth.
"Melanie!"
a horrified Mark cried.
"Oh, God!
What have you done to her? Look at her, you fucking monster!
Ozzy didn't have the courage to tell him to shut up again.
Umbilicals disconnected, the SI subroutine said. Engaging secondary drive units.
The walls of the docking bay slipped past. Brief glimpse of the Scylla, embraced by the cool gray metal of maintenance platforms. Technicians turning clumsily to stare as they flew past. Then there was the purple sparkle of the pressure curtain over the hull, followed by the infinite black of space. The planet formed a huge, steel-gray crescent, cutting across the stars. One of the space flowers was almost directly below them, a perfect half-circle of rumpled amethyst that suddenly vanished as it crossed into the penumbra. "Have we got enough power to make it to Dyson Alpha?" Ozzy asked the SI subroutine.
"Yes."
He debated whether to ask the obvious. Decided to go for it. "And get back?"
"Yes."
"Okay. Plot a course and take us there."
"Working."
"Are you going to kill me now?" Mark was looking at him with the kind of wild eyes that belonged to a dying animal.
"Nobody's going to kill you," Ozzy said.
He hurriedly told the SI subroutine to block all access to the onboard arrays, apart from his own. Mark was the lead assembly technician, who knew what he'd embedded in the frigate's systems.
"You will,"
Mark said fearfully.
"Your type always does." "Now wait up one goddamn minute here. I'm not any kind of type. You just hijacked a Dynasty frigate. I don't have a lot of choice here, man. You're going to kill me, you bastard."
"I'm not. I can't."
Ozzy waved his arms around for emphasis, wincing as he slapped the back of his hand against the arrays. "I'm not wet-wired for anything but a few bioneural chips.
I swear, man. You're perfectly safe. So just chill out."
The silence stretched out dangerously.
"What?" Mark demanded. I really needed the frigate. I probably exaggerated what I'd do. Heat of the moment, dude. I was desperate." "You piece of shit."
"What can I say? I'm sorry." Mark glared at him and folded his arms across his chest. It wasn't an easy position to maintain in zero-G, but he managed it. "Will you be telling Melanie you're sorry?"
"We are going FTL, the SI subroutine announced.
Ozzy braced himself. There'd probably be a rush of acceleration, space twisting around him, stars blue-shifting before they collided into a burst of light ahead and stretched out to envelop the hull.
"She'll get relifed," he mumbled, trying to ignore the spike of shame.
"Well, that makes it all right, then." Mark deliberately and defiantly slapped a hand on an eye spot.
"What's happening?"
Ozzy asked the SI subroutine.
"Please define context."
"Why haven't we gone FTL?"
"We have.
We are currently traveling at 13.5 light-years per hour."
"Holy shit!"
A huge smile split Ozzy's face.
"Really?"
If he was designing the ship, he'd build in a little flicker of the cabin lights, a deep throbbing sound, just something to emphasize the tremendous forces at work within the drive.
"Confirmed."
"Wow.
You've blocked me out of the arrays," Mark said.
"Sure have."
"Hey,
do you know how fast we're traveling?"
13 light-years per hour."
"Jeez, that's like just 3 days to Dyson Alpha. Man, me and Nige should have tried to build something like this back at the start, and to hell with wormholes. This is like totally money, straight and neat.
A straight, quick trip to our death, more like."
"I like that, man. You're about to make history in this ship."
"You mean like the Titanic?"
"Nigel Sheldon is calling you," the SI subroutine said. Ozzy twitched inside his protective webbing. A huge rush of guilt overtook his relief at pulling off the hijack. Then alarm kicked in.
"How is he doing that?"
"The frigate uses a method of communication called a trans-dimensional channel. It is a subfunction of the main drive."
"Man, I am, like, really going to have to read the instruction book. He can't track us with that, can he?"
"The TD channel can be made directional in order to facilitate tracking."
"Christ. Make sure it's not doing that right now."
"Confirmed."
Okay. Cool. Put Nigel on. Turn around, Ozzy. Nigel's eerily calm voice filled the cabin. Bring the frigate back, please. Mark smiled in satisfaction and gave Ozzy a challenging look.
Can't do that, man, Ozzy said. And you know it. I worked out a way to reactivate the barrier. I'm going to use a quantum buster against the Starflyer gadget that's messing with the generator's quantum state.
There is a Trojan program in the TD signal, the SI subroutine reported. I believe they are trying to take command of the ship by remote.
Can you counter it?
I believe so. It is not a type I have in my catalog.
Any problem? Cut the link immediately.
Ozzy, Nigel said, we need the Charybdis to eliminate the prime threat. Bring her back. Now.
Course set. Anchors up. Sails to the wind.
Sorry, Nige, man. I'm committed. Ozzy, we have other frigates. They will be flown by people who understand how to use them properly. I will assign them to hunt you down and kill you. After that, I will make sure you are never relifed. I can do this, and you know it.
You know what, Nige? If you succeed in that, then genocide Morning Light Mountain. I don't think I'd want to live in the kind of galaxy left over afterward.
Mark, Nigel said, I'm sorry for what's about to happen, but we cannot allow Ozzy to hand over the Charybdis to Morning Light Mountain. You have my personal word, you will be relifed immediately. I will also ensure that Liz, Barry, and Sandy will be taken care of in the meantime.
Mark sniffed. He wiped away the moisture, clotting his eyes.
I understand, sir. Tell Otis to shoot straight.
Thank you, Mark. Once again, I'm proud you are family.
Ozzy groaned in dismay and gave Mark a sullen glance. Since when did you turn into a bonehead hero?
Fuck you,
Mark spat. Nige, you know damn well I am not turning this frigate over to Morning Light Mountain, Ozzy said angrily. I'm going to stop you and it from killing each other. You've stolen the only two items of technology that can guarantee the human race survives the war, Ozzy.
This isn't dicking around. This isn't playing the wacky smartass to my corporate stiff. You are attempting to kill humanity. Do you understand that?
I'm going to save you, Ozzy barked back at him.
Trust me, Nige. You always used to.
Please.
Come back.
No. You come with me.
Ozzy hated how petulant he sounded. Switch the TD channel off, he told the SI subroutine.
Confirmed.
Ozzy took a couple of minutes out, just staring at the system's displays in front of him, allowing his temper to cool. He didn't like to admit to himself just how rattled he'd been by Nigel's threats. In the end, he released the plastic bands from his arms, just keeping his legs loosely restrained, and drew a breath.
Hey, Mark,
Nigel doesn't actually have a fleet of these frigates, does he? I mean, they're all still being built, right?
Honestly?
He has the Scylla, and three more which have just completed assembly. None of them have been flight-tested, but they passed their systems integration trials. Otis flew Charybdis against Hell's Gateway with a damn sight less preparation than that.
Great. Thanks for that, man.
I officially appoint you Chief Morale Officer. Ozzy could see this was going to be a flight with minimal conversation.
Where's the food? I need a decent meal.
Mark's smile was the kind used by evil emperors at their victory celebrations.
What food?
We left before the stores were brought on board.